Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And welcome to The Food Fight, where we offer a different perspective on food culture issues around Australia and the world.
We'll talk with chefs, producers, business owners and experts to hear their stories and find out what makes them tick.
This episode we chat with Rushani Ipper from Culinary Magazine and Time Out Melbourne about food and culture and about amplifying diverse voices in food and food media. All right, welcome to another episode of the Food Fight podcast. My name is Steph Postuma. I'm your host, alongside my co-host, as always, Simon Evans.
Hello.
To begin this podcast, we'd like to do an acknowledgement of country. Here where we are, we'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which we gather and speak today, and pay respect to elders past, present, and emerging. Let's introduce our guest. Thank you so much for joining me. We're here with Rushani Ipper. Thank you so much for being
here.
It's great to have you on.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
I know, yeah. So are we. And you're doing some amazing things in the world of food media, which, like, there's so much stuff that we want to get into. This conversation will be pretty heavily focused around culture and diversity. And I think a good way to start is for you to tell us a bit about yourself and your background and how that influenced, you know, developing a love for food.
Yeah, great. I've got a lot to say.
Yeah, go for it. Let's go.
Where do I start? I suppose maybe I'll start from the very start of my journey, I suppose. So I am a Sri Lankan Australian, second generation. So my parents were born in Sri Lanka and migrated here in the 80s. That's definitely really heavily influenced the person I am today. I think, and that makes me a person of color. I guess that's where it all started from. I studied journalism as well, purely because I was also always really interested in race and, issues pertaining to race and always asking questions from my family and whatnot about things like that. And then I guess that's what led me towards food journalism is growing up with so much amazing food. I don't know if you know too much about Sri Lankan culture, but we love eating and we eat like from morning to night, constantly just eating and talking and coming together over a communal table, people popping in, you know, the house for a cup of tea, and it's a very communal kind of culture. And so I've grown up with like heaps of great food. But there was at one point in my life when, like, during my childhood, I'd say, I think being the kid that would take like a thermos full of curry and rice to school, I would, you know, get bullied for that because kids would be like, oh, what's that smell? What are you eating? Right. And, you know, because I wasn't taking a Vegemite sandwich. And so that definitely shaped the person I am today because I grew up, you know, going home to a very Sri Lankan household where my mother would say, why are you speaking in that accent? Like referring to my Australian accent and saying, you have to speak in your Sri Lankan accent. So I would even switch up my accent at home.
Wow.
And then, you know, leaving the house to a very, you know, Australian culture. So definitely balancing. It was a balancing act. And I guess that, yeah, that shaped the person I am today because I know who I am now. I've shaped my identity, whereas before I was still figuring it all out. And I see a lot of other, you know, First Nations, Black or people of colour in a similar situation and younger people that's still figuring it out. And I think that's why I'm really passionate about doing what I do, because I want people to feel comfortable in who they are and own it, you know, and own our culture and represent your culture however you want to, but be proud of it. So I guess that's why I'm focusing on the things I am today and why I bring race into food media. Yeah, I don't know if that answers
Yeah, no, that definitely
like a really
does.
Long-winded way of saying it.
How... When you were studying journalism, at what point did you decide or what maybe opportunity arose where food media was the place where you would, you know, be able to discuss some of these issues that you're talking about and, you know, use your experience as a part of your professional career? Because you could have done that just as a journalist or as a feature writer or something like that, but you went into food.
It actually didn't happen for me during uni, funnily enough.
Right.
It happened way after, like in more recent years, actually. And I'm 28 now, or turning 28. but yeah, it didn't happen for me during uni. I think during uni, I was still figuring it all out and figuring out my identity still at that point. Yeah, so it happened for me later on, and I think I've just always been quite interested in food, but I never saw food media as a viable career option. And I think maybe that was the Sri Lankan family, you know, the speaking to me about it, because at first they weren't sure about me, you know, studying journalism either. So I guess it's just been a journey for me. Yeah, I don't know.
Was there a point where you decided, like, where was the point where you were like, I'm really interested in food and food media is the place I want to sort of work towards? Because it's a competitive, it's a competitive game, food media. So it seems to me that in order to develop a career in it, you have to work towards it. It's not like you can just be a writer and then you'll fall into food writing.
100%,
I don't know who you have to... Very few people go, I want to be a food writer. You have to be a good writer and then have a love for food on top of that. It seems like most people in food writing, like quite famous reviewers, like Jay Rayner in the UK, started off as like writing about like homicides and stuff.
Yeah.
And then he just moved into food because he had a natural love for food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, of course.
100%. I think I figured it out like maybe 5 years ago, which, you know, isn't that long ago in the scheme of things. But I just remember reading a lot. Obviously, I read a lot anyway, being a journalist and whatnot. But reading a lot, especially looking at the Good Food Guide, that was something that I would read a lot because I'd always want to know where the best spots to eat were and whatnot. And I was quite intrigued by the whole industry and wanted to get into it. But I definitely found it really difficult to crack into. And it took me having to start culinary to be able to crack into the industry.
Okay.
So I had to start my own thing.
Right.
You know,
so that's where you first got your first opportunity.
That was my big break,
like
so to speak. And that was just last year.
Yeah. Okay. And what were you doing like in that original stage, say 5 years ago, was it that journey of sort of, you know, writing blogs and trying to contribute free articles to things like, you know, Broadsheet Time Out, like those sorts of places and develop a portfolio?
100%. But even then I found... trying to be a journalist and trying to even crack into that kind of thing and become a freelance journalist for publications like that was really hard.
Yeah.
You know, you have to essentially know people or have some kind of existing network. And that was definitely one of the motivating things for me to start culinary. Because I know that it's really hard for emerging writers, especially if you are of colour, to find your way in food media. There aren't as many opportunities out there.
Why do you think the fact that you're a person of colour, you know, affected your ability to get a job? Like, where did that play a role? Is this just a part of the broader conversation around whiteness in our institutions?
Yeah, 100%. I think, and there's a really good article out there which I encourage everyone to read, written by Colin Ho and Nick Jordan for the ABC. It was published in 2018. And in it, they kind of go into the nitty-gritty. In 2018, 81% of Good Food Guide and Gourmet Traveller reviewers were white. When you look at the executive teams, I'm not so sure in this current day and age, but back then they were all white. And that really plays a part in the kinds of people they're hiring. Obviously, I can't speak for now and I won't, but I know that that was definitely an issue. And again, as I said it really comes down to who you know a lot of the time as well, and who you've networked with. And that can be really difficult, especially when they're looking for a certain kind of person, or even the way that they report on things, it might not sit right with you as well. And that can be another issue for POC as well, First Nations or Black people too. So a lot of it, yeah. It's interesting. My position at Culinary, I've been getting a lot of emails because I put a call out for writers, whether you're emerging, published or whatnot. And I've had a lot of people getting in touch being like, I've found it so difficult to find a position to write for anyone because I haven't had any work published because I can't get any work published. And so it's like this catch 22.
Is it even like the content of things you're writing, if there's no one, no one who's shares a similar heritage, and that they might not even be able to connect with what you're writing about. To the point then that, like, if you're submitting articles and they're like, I have no idea what she's talking about, and then dismiss it as not you know, viable to publish. Is it kind of even down to the content?
I mean, yeah, I'd be intrigued because, I mean, I'm not white myself, so I can't really tell what other people are thinking. But, you know, as an editor myself, what I look for is content that people are actually really passionate about talking about. And that's my point of difference with Culinary, because I want people to explore their own cultures and champion those cultures. I don't want someone who is of a different culture championing someone else's culture unless they're really invested in it, if that makes sense. And I think, like, historically looking at the kinds of places that, you know, are championed and whatnot, they tend to be white owned or, you know, the big institutions, you know, your Chris Lucas's, your Andrew McConnell's and whatnot. So to speak, the little guys aren't heralded as much, and I think that's something that I'd love to change if possible.
I mean, you see it in the Good Food Guide, the restaurants that are listed.
Yes.
This is quite overwhelming whiteness to all of them. And exactly. even a lot of the, you know, Asian restaurants that are in the guide would have white owners.
Exactly.
So I mean, yeah, it's quite glaring in the result.
And for you to know that and speak about that as well, I mean, it's proof, you know, it's proof in the pudding.
In say 2018, or, you know, this time period that we're talking about, sort of maybe before you started Culinary, what was your view of the content of food media and, you know, diversity and representation in its content? Did you feel, you know, having the background that you do, there wasn't enough for you to connect to someone of your experience?
It was very, like, glaringly obvious that there was a huge lack of diversity, and we've only seen that in the past 2 years, really, that there's started to be an increase in diversity in these industries. I think a huge thing, which also spurred me on with Culinary, was the Black Lives Matter movement that peaked in June last year. You know, well and truly into the pandemic, but that was also occurring. It was a lot. But after that, I'm not sure if you guys have noticed it as well, but I've definitely seen the conversation that started the conversation for people to start noticing that there is a huge lack of diversity in these industries.
There's definitely, was quite aware that, and you see it on social media, on the news, and what people are talking about was conversations about representation, conversations about like things like black owned businesses and supporting black owned businesses and you know, First Nations people of color voices was much more prominent, whereas a conversation you would have with your friends, where before you probably wouldn't have really considered it, to the point where I'd definitely try to spend money in you know, Aboriginal owned businesses. I use a lot of native ingredients, and it makes sense that my, you know, my shampoo comes from an Aboriginal owned company, and is making those little differences, which I think do add up. So I think that's definitely much more in people's minds, something to consider in almost everything you do.
Exactly. Yeah, we're just starting that conversation now. I hope that we keep going on with it, and I hope that this leads to a lot more progress in the next, you know, 10, 20 years or whatnot, and especially for the future generations as well.
Yeah, and I mean, this will segue nicely into Culinary in a second, but, you know, there can only be positives in terms of empowering people of colour to pursue a career in, whether it be writing or being a chef or being a producer, where there might have been a, you know, a sentiment beforehand that, you know, someone like me might not be able to crack this industry because, like, I don't see anyone that looks like me around.
Exactly. Yeah.
Seeing more of that in recent times.
Always better when there's multiple voices, exactly. And multiple backgrounds, and multiple ethnicities. Like,
exactly.
Like you've seen it, like in history across the world.
Exactly.
Like the more different voices and ideas we have, like food is better and tastier. Mm. Exactly. So for minimal, for that reason, for more tasty food,
yeah.
This is a conversation that should be had.
Exactly. I mean, look at like why colonization happened in so many countries. The spice trade. Mm. Because people wanted the different spices from different countries. I just don't understand why we aren't involving those people in the conversation, you know? It just baffles me.
Mm. I think you've already answered the question of, in a way, you've already answered the question of why did you want to start culinary. But maybe... Take us back to sort of the first time you were thinking about putting together a publication and your thought process when you were like, well, how can I do something important to me and pursue a career in this industry? I know, I'll start a publication.
I definitely didn't expect it to take off or anything.
Yeah.
I guess when I get really frustrated or angry at a situation, I like to do something about it.
Mm.
And so the whole thing that happened last year with the BLM movement really spurred me on to take action. And that led to me creating Culinary just as a website and calling it a magazine, but effectively it was just a website and it was just me writing and interviewing people. But I think branding it as a magazine really helped. Mm. Because then people were like, oh, it's a magazine, it's called a magazine, it's a magazine. Mm. And now I'm like, yes, it is a magazine. Yeah. And like we're releasing our first print issue soon, so which is exciting.
Super exciting.
Yeah. But yes, yeah, I think that just having that confidence and that mentality, and I believed in it from the start, and then I just saw that it just started getting all of this attention, people started hearing about it, it started to get a following, and I just kept doing what I was doing and interviewing people and trying to get people on board, and you know, soon I had a little team of volunteers, and and I guess that's what created it.
Was there any how rigid was, you know, your ideas about the, you know, the issues and stuff that you'd cover, the people? Was it a sort of this is just a broad spectrum place for amplifying voices and things, or, you know, these are the types of things we specifically want to be covering and doing?
100%. I think, like, what I've always told myself is I'm just going to take it as it comes and see how I go. And that's what I've been doing. But to start off with, I just said I wanted submissions from or stories about First Nations, Black and people of colour, because that's who I want to champion through the magazine. And, you know, whether that's an interview or a story, you know, a personal account, that's kind of what we're focusing on. And on the flip side, recipes, which I love to cook. I love food. Mm. And I just think, you know, when you Google a recipe or whatnot, and this is a really interesting thing that I read about recently, say you're looking up a recipe for pad thai or something, most of the time what will surface on Google according to SEO are English language recipes. Mm. So you won't, and I'm not going to use the word authentic, but traditional, traditional recipes, you know, by Thai people, probably won't surface as high as something written by a white person.
Mm.
And that can be quite frustrating, because often with SEO, it's not going to surface things that were written in Thai. So that's another thing to take into consideration. So what I try to do is have recipes written by people who are passionate, who are of that culture, and then publish that in English. So then hopefully that will, you know, go higher up in SEO and we see more of that.
Mm. That's a great idea. Yeah. Because you do just like whenever I'm looking for recipes, it's generally just a scroll of like, I don't want that website, I don't want that website. Yes. So I'm looking for something like for a restaurant. So I don't want it to be like, take a cup of this and two cups of that. Like, I want like grams for one, or I want some like understanding about what I'm doing. So it just takes like a long scroll of trying to find like which especially if like I cook a lot of Indian at home, and I'm always trying to find like more deeper knowledge about that, and that takes a big scroll to find like a blog post or like something someone's written rather than like an SBS recipe. 100%. SBS are great, but
Like
generally the basic home cook recipes.
Yes, yeah, yeah, 100%. And that's just another thing we're trying to kind of work with, I suppose. And it's cool because we have so many incredible chefs in not only Melbourne but the whole country, right? Some of the best executive chefs as well that I know, like I'm trying to get them on board for, well, we have got them on board for the first print issues, which I'm really excited for. So we've got like John Rivera, who does Keraton Sorbetes, and we've got Tom Serafian as well, and Harry Mungat. So I'm really excited because they're going to represent their own cuisine in a way as well, which is going to be so exciting. It's something awesome. You might not see at the fine diners that they've worked at and whatnot. So it'll be really cool.
Cool. How, when you sort of first started, was your sourcing of stories and people and voices to feature in culinary, was that mostly through submissions, or did you sort of have a list of things you wanted to cover yourself? And when it's, because I think it sort of might lead into the, you know, the question about Google and stuff like that. It's like if you're trying to find a story that isn't covered by mainstream food media that might be, you know, right down the list somewhere, like it can be difficult. You know, we all know that there's so many amazing stories out there, but I think specifically in this instance, they might be hard to find. Mm-hmm. Have you experienced that? And, you know, how do you sort of find stories that are not amplified outside of submissions?
Yeah, it's a really good call. So at the start, to be completely honest, we didn't get that many submissions, just a handful, very small handful. So a lot of it was just me. I like to think I've got my finger on the pulse in food media. So thinking of issues that I felt needed to be explored or people that deserve to be interviewed. So, for example, Ross Magnay, who used to work at Rice Paper Scissors, and now he like does a lot of pop-ups and things. He's a fantastic Filipino chef.
Love Rice Paper Scissors.
Yeah, so good. Yeah. So I interviewed him, and he was a real pleasure. And I've actually noticed since we've interviewed him, looking at the website and the analytics and stuff, and where our clicks are coming from, people are searching him on Google and we're surfacing at the top. Cool. And the same for Roisin from Etta, which is really exciting. And that didn't come from me being like, okay, who's going to surface on SEO? It was just thinking of who I felt should be interviewed, whose story I wanted to hear. And then commissioning those kinds of pieces to people as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. Because like a lot of the time these stories aren't told in a long form, you know,
like a story
interview and stuff. And Google likes content, you know, and I sort of like have found a similar thing exploring regions and producers because, you know, I might have found an oyster farmer or a cheesemaker on the south coast of New South Wales, and I've known that they've been there for years and I've always loved their products, but no one's bothered to go down and interview them and write it up and put it on a website. So I see myself, like I see my business surfacing as well, like when you search for these sorts of people and stuff. And it's a great way to, like, I mean, you know, a part of what you're doing is building a business and building an organization and increasing your reach and engagement for the better of everything. So
I think the ability to see those cracks and go, like, the way Google works means this happens to these people, like being able to identify those cracks and then work out ways to actually solve them, that's amazing, because there's a lot of times things that people just wouldn't occur to them and they wouldn't think about until it's brought to your attention, and then you're like,
yeah, 100%.
I mean, that's kind of, I guess that's one of the main points, is getting people to think and to realize with these things that could be quite obvious on face value but you just don't think about.
100%. And I think like a big thing as well is like a lot of this has happened very organically for me. I haven't gone out there with like a capitalist mindset, so I've been quite fortunate, I think, but obviously there is a demand for this kind of knowledge as well. that might change. Who knows? I guess because I'm not a businesswoman. I am not too sure of what I'm doing. But you know, it's working. I'm going with it. And in future, I would like to kind of create more of a business model and target things and whatnot. But I also kind of like that organic approach because then it means that you're really focusing on what's important, you know.
Mm. I was thinking that. I was like, if you like Googled like black representation in food media, you'd probably get like an article about a white person about how it's a problem.
Yeah,
that's like that's just like weirdly ironic that's what would come up if you Googled that.
Did you notice that when you were starting culinary? And
I mean, there was that really problematic article. I don't know if you guys recall. Is it the Guardian? I can't remember the publication now. But it was about how this person wrote about like Asian fruit. And I think they were a Thai correspondent or something like that.
Mm.
And she wrote about how a rambutan looked like a COVID. Oh,
really?
And how like pungent and smelly durian was, and just reported on it really badly.
Yeah.
I remember the ABC approaching myself and Lee Tran Lam from Diversity in Food Media about that as well. And they asked us for comment, and it's just that kind of thing. Someone that isn't of that culture, that has no idea what they're talking about, and just really rude. Or really poor reporting, or the lack of representation.
That kind of the perceived exoticness.
Yes, 100%.
Of foreign ingredients, and it we get it here, and this is kind of where it springs up in a lot of stuff I cook. Like we did a spot on Studio 10. I mean, it was just like a little kangaroo dish, like cooked quite raw with some other like little beach herbs.
Mm.
And the like bottom third part was like, will the presenters eat this wacky dish?
Oh my God.
And we were like, and then there was a whole thing of like, what other countries eat their coat of arms?
Oh,
and like, and
wow.
we had no idea. We just went on to like, on telly to do a cook. And then this is all it. And we're like, oh God, like, can we get away?
The complete opposite of what you were trying to do at
so
your restaurant.
Bad.
Yeah. Red meat. Like,
it's also really delicious.
Yeah, exactly. But just the perceived notion of I mean, yeah, even ingredients that grow in this country naturally. Yeah. But yeah, like that things are, weird or smelly or gross or whatever they are. And then therefore there's no inherent value in them. That's just such a dangerous, pervasive thing that we have.
100%.
In sort of Western culture, I guess.
Yeah, 100%. And then it's interesting to see like the flow-on effect of how native bush foods and just like, you know, it's 1%, I think, First Nations people that actually produce their own native bush foods, and that just, it really baffles me.
Yeah.
But then to see how it's trendy as well. Mm. And it's, that's a whole other kettle of fish.
Well, yeah, we did an hour and a half podcast about specifically this with Dwayne Bannon Harrison up on the South Coast.
Yeah.
Which was an interesting one too.
With Christian from Yerobinjan.
And Christian.
We'd sort of say, same conversations about the food logistics and how there's no money actually going from a lot of these ingredients, and how important it is to try and buy from Aboriginal owned businesses, or at least businesses where money's going back in the community.
Yes, exactly.
And sort of fair pathways. So, I mean, that's like, it's an issue we have right in our country, in their country, that's on our doorstep, that stuff that grows here and we have those problems.
Yeah, exactly.
We were talking earlier about, you know, where you're looking to go. Is currently what you're doing relatively Victorian centric?
Yes, at the moment. Yeah. But I would like to expand.
Yeah.
I guess I was just trying to use Melbourne as a base. To use Melbourne a base and then see how that goes, and then expand gradually. Yeah, for sure. Make it Australia wide.
Yeah, because there's some amazing cultural diversity in places like Darwin and up north,
100%.
And really awesome. I think the north of Australia is a place that seems to be really overlooked in food 100%. Media, in terms of, you know, both Indigenous food and multiculturalism.
Yes.
There's amazing histories up there, like a place like Broome with a, you know, Japanese pearl diving history and things like that, or you know, like apparently I haven't been to Darwin yet, but
the
apparently
Luxa?
Yeah,
they do really good Luxa.
Luxa, yeah. But apparently the farmers markets in Darwin is just,
I've heard that,
absolutely unbelievable. So, are you sort of excited about what's possible?
Yeah, 100%. Because it's yeah, the world is our oyster, really.
Mm.
And Melbourne is just a way for me to start, only because it's quite difficult for me financially as well to look at other cities right now.
Yeah.
But definitely the end goal is to incorporate. And that's a great way to incorporate more First Nations people into the dialogue as well, which is incredibly important to me. Mm. Yeah.
Tell us about moving from, you know, starting like being a journalist, looking at doing food writing, starting culinary, and now writing for Time Out, and you're an editor at Time Out here in Melbourne. Like, when did that opportunity come, and what's that sort of, you know, short part of your career? You only started last year.
Yeah, we started in September last year, so not very long ago at all. Mm. And again, a lot of these opportunities arose from culinary. So they found me via a friend, Alex. She's part of Diversity in Food Media Australia, and she'd heard of culinary, heard of me. And then she'd referred me to editorial director Cass. And then, yeah, that's kind of how it all began. And they approached me, and I was like, yes, I would love to do this. This is like a dream role, yes. And, yeah, it's been great. So I'm the food and drink editor for Time Out in
Amazing.
Melbourne. Yeah, so it's
what
it's
a cool
really
job.
Good. It's great. It's a real dream job. Yeah. I'm very, very fortunate.
Yeah.
So it's been interesting balancing culinary and Time Out, but it's fun. I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah. What are some of the give us some of the sort of cool things you've been a part of? Obviously, the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival just wrapped up their first edition of this year's Melbourne Food
That's
and Wine
right.
Festival.
Yes, there's more to come. Yeah.
Were you involved in that?
Yes, so I did this. It was really cool. I almost forgot. Oh my gosh.
yes.
Pat put together this really cool with Visit Victoria's guide to like snacks across Melbourne, which was really cool. Yeah, all the different. So it was like, you know, north, east, southwest. And so he commissioned a few of these snacks to a bunch of writers, including myself, which was really fun to work on. And I got to highlight some Sri Lankan places, which were very dear to me. Mm. And it was really nice just seeing the diversity in the snacks that were chosen as well all across Victoria, and highlighting that, you know, a snack isn't just a sandwich. There's a lot more to it, which was really cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's fun.
Is that obviously a goal as editor of Time Out now to maybe like right some of the wrongs you've seen going up to that, even with, you know, hiring policy and what gets written about?
Yeah, 100%. In terms of content, it's something I'd like to see change. I think Time Out's been quite nuanced though, and I really admire it as a publication. But I think that we can all kind of learn, and we can all kind of change a little bit and whatnot. One thing that I was really, I guess, honoured that Time Out would let me do was write about the rickshaw bar. I don't know if you that old chestnut.
Yeah. Like a lot of people were talking about that.
I'm not familiar with it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
You're not in hospital.
Yeah.
like a lot of like my friends in hospitality in Wollongong were talking about that. People were like, did you read about that bar?
Yeah.
It was like, well, like just.
So can you tell, for people who don't know about it, Rishan, can you tell
us? Yes, for sure. Oh, it's my favorite thing to talk about. No, I'm just kidding. so I might give you a bit of backstory as well as to what actually happened there. So I receive a lot of press releases on a daily basis to my Time Out inbox. One such press release that caught my eye that I forwarded onto my team was about this place called Rickshaw Bar in Richmond, which is, as we discussed, on Victoria Street, a very heavily like Vietnamese populated area, huge Vietnamese community. They were opening a Vietnam War themed bar right in the heart of it. And I just, when I saw the press release, the words that I read were like, there are going to be empty bullet shells strewn throughout the venue and, you know, real like orange, cognizant of like Agent Orange.
Yeah.
You know, and like army style, whatever, get up and everything. And it was like charred foods and just, it just all just seemed really off.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, really off. And they were like, you know, it's reminiscent of 70s Saigon. We're like, well, there's only one thing that happened then.
Yeah.
And for South Vietnamese people, it's a really awful thing that happened to them, right? And not even just them, that like the war veterans and whatnot that would still suffer from PTSD to this day. So when I received that, I just didn't understand if this was a real, like how it was a real thing.
Yeah, it sounds like parody.
It does. Like, it really read like parody. One of
the photos I saw was like a pint glass
with
full with bullets and then beer on top. Just strange. Like it was baffling. Incredibly. Like it could have been a Chaser article.
Yes, 100%. So I flagged that with the team, and then I'm really fortunate my editor, Beck, she got in touch with the PR agency and said, we don't approve of this. This is not something we will publish. And also it's incredibly tone deaf. You might want to revise this. Mm. And so we received a response from the PR agency saying the team will be sitting down. They didn't realize that wasn't their intent. And they will, you know, talk about it this week. I waited for 2 weeks and I was like eagerly watching their Instagram page and everything, waiting to hear back, heard nothing. And then I was like, okay, we've given them 2 weeks to make amends now. Mm. I think that's long enough. So then I contacted my friend Nhoc Tran, who ran a great Vietnamese restaurant called Shop Bao Nhoc in Brunswick. And she has she's an activist as well, and she has a great following. And she posted about it to her followers, and it just went viral. It went crazy. And then all these people were, you know, lambasting them and bombarding their Instagram profile with all these comments like, this is disgusting and whatnot. And heaps of Vietnamese people were as well. Sorry, South Vietnamese people. And yeah, it just went off. And then I spoke to my editorial director and managing director, and I said, can I please finally write something about this now? And they're like, yes. And then I got to write a very nuanced piece, unlike a few other publications, that just like took screen grabs of Instagram shots and whatnot. I actually spoke to an academic that was North Vietnamese. I spoke to my friend who's a South Vietnamese. And got some quotes and some comments and just portrayed how offensive this is and how ridiculous it is that venues can, in 2021, still get away with this kind of stuff. It's disgusting.
It brings up a really interesting issue which has been sort of covered recently in food media, which is, you know, white-owned ethnic restaurants.
Yeah.
Mm. And I think we've got established, like, Rickshaw Bar is on the, like, hugely offensive and disgusting end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
And on the other end, we've got white-owned ethnic restaurants like, for example, you know, David Thompson or someone like that who's been working, like, who's been, you know, infatuated with Thai food for 30 years or something like that and you know, brought it into Australia and stuff. And then also the work of people like Jock and Ben, and you work a lot with Indigenous ingredients and things like that as well. Like, are we in this really sort of tricky and challenging time where people, white business owners who, you know, have a passion for a certain type of ethnic cuisine have to be really, really careful about how they approach that? And how do we go about making sure people fit into an acceptable level of the spectrum? And there was a recent article about it, and I can't remember, the author. Yeah.
Yvonne Lam, from Gourmet Traveler,
About the Some Young Guys.
Yes, yeah. My fave, yeah.
South.
Yes, it was a really great article.
Yeah, it definitely brought up some interesting points. I think this, just going back to the rickshaw thing, I think when you do get these things happen, and especially on social media, and there's outrage and people are sort of angry about it and about it, it needs some nuance and needs some context, and it needs a deeper dive into
logic.
It to kind of explain to people, like, this is why this is wrong.
Yes.
Because I think you, like, people have obviously the right to be outraged and to voice that how they want, but then there is the need, I think, for someone to come in and bring it all together to explain to people, because that's the only way that people are going to change is if it's actually explained to them rather than people just getting angry from both sides. Or for a bit of anger as well. We need a bit of everything. But I think we definitely need that context.
100%. And even with culinary, that's something that I really aim to do, because that's why I try to channel my anger into quite like a productive way. Not to say that everyone has to do that.
Yeah, you know?
People have different lived experiences. But that's the way I like to do it, is to bring facts into it, to bring a nuanced view into it and show logically how it's wrong, you know, to people that might not otherwise understand.
So where do you see it in terms of like, how do we navigate these waters? Because I think that like, you know, the amplification of Indigenous food and subsequently an understanding of Indigenous food history here in Australia via Jock and Ben and people like that is a positive thing. You know, how do we navigate these waters?
Jock got a lot of shit recently.
Yes.
Well, he has.
With the database.
Yeah, I mean, wrongly for a lot of it, I think.
Yeah.
But there were some First Nations people who were quite angry with him as well, and he's done a lot and always tried to do it the right way from what I know. So it'll be
interesting to see how that database pans out though.
Yeah. Mm. I mean,
is that still sort of...
No, it's been completed.
He had a whole chat about it as well.
Which he did... recorded like a Facebook Live about it.
Yeah, I was part of that.
But it's with a Aboriginal group, and it's basically up to them to do with it what they want, which was the intent, the purpose of stuff. I think a lot of it is just it took a long time.
And certain groups can do with it what they will, you know. Yeah. And there's also censored information, like very sensitive information in there.
Yeah, there's like a lot of stuff that local
a lot of red tape
Don't want that information out.
Like
Christian said, he's like, there's some stuff like that you'll never hear of. To me. That's fair.
I think the whole thing was that it was being handled by a white person. But I guess it's a catch 22 because he had the power to sort of get those wheels in motion. I think with going back to what you said, I think the biggest thing is it cultural appropriation?
Yes.
Or is it cultural appreciation? And there's a really fine line between the two. And sometimes it can be a grey area. The way I see it personally is like, for example, someone like Fuchsia Dunlop, for example, white woman who has written extensively about Chinese cuisine, namely Sichuan cuisine. She was the first Westerner to study at the Sichuan Institute in Chengdu. And I think that's appreciation because she's gone out there, she's done the work, she's taken the time to actually connect with the culture and the people and make sure it's okay with them, and then sort of bring it to the Western world, so to speak, but introduce it, but in a way that isn't ridding people of their culture, or in a way that she's claiming ownership of it. And I think that's appreciation, and you know, cultural appropriation is, you know, your rickshaw bars and white owners that fail to recognize the culture that they're claiming to herald the cuisine that they're claiming to herald. Another thing I think is like involving someone of that actual culture in the journey, you know, I don't see why it's so hard. If you're so passionate about it, you should be passionate about the people as well. Mm-hmm. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, like the Some Young Guys thing, I think was an interesting one because you don't feel like there was any malicious intent behind there, because it was down to their branding, really.
Just stupid. Stupidity.
And for white people, when you're having these conversations recently, and they've been 5-6 years, so I mean, it probably wasn't a problem, but I think it's about like, moving with the times, like example is like Lobo Plantation run bar in Sydney. It changed their name a year or two ago just to Lobo because they realized that the implications of plantation, and like I think that's just really good, smart, like, oh yeah, shit, we've done something wrong here, let's correct that.
100%. And that's the thing, like, you can be corrected on something, you might not realize that, but you not realizing that something offends someone else is a privilege in itself. And it's really important to recognize that and reconcile it. And I think the biggest thing you can do is, in that position of privilege, understand that you're hurting someone else. Take a moment, you know, do your research. And then if it is actually offensive, get rid of it. It's not that hard. And I think with Some Young Guys, they were given the opportunity by Gourmet Traveller and Yvonne Lamb to make comments, to change things. And they were just really arrogant about it. and very forthright. And I think that is like the worst case of privilege, you know. That's not what you should do. And if you're going to do that, then you're showing your true colors. That's how I feel about it.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting point about Lobo Plantation and just in general about any business that's, you know, serving ethnic cuisine, white-owned business serving ethnic cuisine, to take stock of where they're at and be on the front foot in terms of, you know, their identity and how that fits in with the food and the culture that they're showing through their food, and making changes where necessary, seeking information, seeking feedback, talking with people in food media and things like that, and ensuring that, like, you know, if you're offending people, and you might need to be active about seeking out whether or not, you know, to find out whether or not you actually are, but active and on the front foot.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I've thought a lot about with being passionate about native Australian ingredients, and that leading to wanting to learn and find out more about Aboriginal culture and history, and then sort of having that on my menus, of making just one, talking to First Nations people and being like, what do you think of this? Like, is this okay? Like, is this cool? And then just make sure you're doing the reading, and just like I remember I spent like a long time on any like Instagram post before, making sure I'm spelling things right, or I'm getting the, you know, capitalization in the right place, and all these things. And I think it's just, you just have to worry about it a little bit.
Yeah.
And then hopefully that will help you find, you know, the best way of doing it, or stop you from doing something that might be a step too far.
Yeah, 100%. And like another thing that we can all actively do, have you heard of Pay the Rent, for example?
Yeah,
so we can all actively pay the rent and provide money to a lot of these First Nations organizations, because at the end of the day we're all settlers on this land, you know, and we're all taking up their space, and I think that's the least we can do. So that's another thing, but I really respect that, and I think that should be the standard, you know. And another thing is like names. So again, going back to Yvonne's article, it was all about problematic restaurant names and what's in a name effectively, and that's something that, you know, First Nations, Black and people of colour have dealt with their entire lives. People either mispronouncing or making fun of your name, and the mockery of a name itself is something that, you know, sometimes you might not do it intentionally, but if you misspell a name, it can really hurt the other person, you know. And that's another thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, the local paper got my name wrong once, and I was like, and I was like, fuck, imagine having that like your whole life.
Yeah.
Like anytime anyone tries to spell your name.
And you've got an easy name to spell.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's why I was even more confused. I was like, I think it was that weird.
I don't think anyone's ever gotten my name right on the first pass.
Yeah.
I've got a double barrel hyphenated surname. I just use the first one. But
it's difficult. I do too.
Really?
I did. Yeah, right. Mine's in classic Sri Lankan fashion, very long.
Can you tell us?
What's I can. Exclusive. No. It's Senavaratna Appa. So I just go by the Appa you call it. Yeah.
Damn it, I pronounced it wrong at the start. Oh.
No, but everyone says Epa and I'm fine with it. I don't mind it.
I said Epa because Victor said Epa yesterday when we were talking about
Epa's fine, yeah.
Okay. Interesting, like, as we, you know, continue to talk about Indigenous culture and Indigenous cuisine, you know, there isn't a history of Indigenous restaurants in Australia in the same way that there are other, you know, migrant-owned restaurants and, you know, Vietnamese food culture or Sri Lankan food culture or Chinese food culture here in Australia, because it's a different history. How we've spoken with, you know, Indigenous people pushing in terms of food and ideas and produce and those sorts of issues and things, but I feel like there's like quite a glaring gap in terms of representation in restaurants. Is that something you're exploring with culinary? And you know, there's some people that you've spoken to and talked to, short stories.
Sam May was the first person that I interviewed for culinary, because I wanted it in particular to be a First Nations person, because again, going back to everything that I just said. So I was very honoured to be able to interview him. He had worked for Charcoal Lane. And I think after culinary, he went on to kind of do a few different things and host classes and stuff like that. But his experience was not what I thought it would be. I think when you hear of... when I'm trying to say it in a proper way. Some of the restaurants he had worked for, I thought were great institutions, especially for First Nations people. It didn't turn out to be that way from what he said. And that was quite eye-opening for me. And it's sad because there, as you mentioned, there aren't many First Nations, at least owned restaurants or First Nations championing restaurants. And that's a real issue. But I guess that's obviously rife in history and opportunity as well, and lack of opportunity. But Sam May was a real pleasure to chat to, and it was nice to see how he was trying to work with First Nations like Bush Foods and whatnot. And yeah, he taught me a lot. Yeah. So cool. That was one of the first people that I interviewed.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool.
So yeah, there is hardly any Indigenous chefs out there with the high profiles. There's a couple of Mabu Mabu Cafe, and Dwayne gets just a lot of lots of publicity for what he does in the South Coast. But I mean, but then there's it's such a strange thing, and this has always been a strange thing for me, is in this country there's more Asian Australian chefs than there are chefs of the people from this land.
Yes.
And that's just quite a baffling thing on the face of it. I can't imagine there's a lot, like, well, maybe in America with sort of Native American people. It might be the only country that has a kind of allegory to that. But yeah, so there is a massive need for, especially when, you know, Native ingredients are so popular across all the top restaurants in the country. We desperately need more voices highlighted, more chefs put forward, and the Indigenous Culinary Association here are really pushing for that, and I really love their goals, and it's something we've wanted to get involved in for quite a while.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's such a massive need for more Aboriginal people in the culinary world 100%. Right now.
I mean, like, it doesn't help that the government did try to commit a genocide against
them. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That'll really set back your goal of wanting to be a chef.
Yeah, exactly. But, like, hopefully we can see more First Nations people actually being involved in the dialogue of their own food. I really hope so. We just need to give them the power to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's where culinary comes in, as well as a lot of other publications.
Yeah, 100%. I certainly hope that we can give them the platform that they deserve. Amazing. Yeah.
Cool. We'll probably start wrapping up. Rishani, is there anything else you wanted to touch on or talk about? How can people get to culinary?
Yeah, oh, sure. So, a bit of a promo. We're in the process of making our first print issue, which is very exciting.
Yeah, great.
That is currently available for pre-order via our website, everyone.
What's the website?
So, it's www.culinary.com, but culinary is a pun, so it's spelled differently. So, it's C-O-L-O-U-R-N-A-R-Y.
Yeah.
So you can find it there. Otherwise, we will host like future events and whatnot. We're hosting a second fundraiser dinner actually in a few weeks' time. That's sold out, which is really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And if anyone wants to contribute at all, please get in touch. I think we're good for the first print issue, but, you know, for ongoing ones and for the website, definitely looking for like writers, photographers, illustrators, or chefs for recipes. I guess that's
great.
That's that.
Exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, just to reiterate with people out there, I'm going to guess, Rishani, that you've spent a lot of unpaid hours working on culinary.
Yes.
And in order for something as important and a publication like this to have longevity, it eventually, you know, needs to be worth, like, well, it's going to be worth your time, but it needs to provide for you as well. So buying and pre-ordering print issues and supporting online and continuing to follow and support publications like this is super, super important.
100%. And we're also accepting donations as well.
Yes.
If that's something people are able to do. But another thing I think is really important is to be really wary of where you're ingesting your media from. And I think a big part of that is, you know, if you want to hear the opinions of First Nations, Black or people of colour, surround yourselves with them. So, you know, Instagram is a great tool for this. There's plenty of people out there. And, you know, Gourmet Traveller is doing really well with Yvonne, who's a digital editor. She's writing a lot of great things at the moment. And then, like, other people I could shout out is Jess Ho. She used to be the food and drink editor for Melbourne, Time Out Magazine Melbourne, and she has a newsletter that she does that you can subscribe to. And then there's also, like, little community groups, like the Entrepreneurs. They're a Filipina, like, activist kind of group. They're great advocates for their culture. And there's so many other people that I've probably missed, but Chef
Diversity
Jenny
in Food Media as
yes,
well.
Diversity
Lee Tran
in
Lam.
Food Media, yes. Lee Tran Lam is amazing. Nick Jordan as well. But there's just so many great people out there that we can all listen to and take note from.
Awesome.
So, yeah.
Cool. Yeah, Rushani, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Hello, dear listeners. Steph here. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of The Food Fight. If you want to get in touch with us, it's at The Food Fight Podcast on Instagram or thefoodfightpodcast@gmail.com. We want to hear from you and we want to talk to you. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really helps. If you want to hit me up, it's quicksandfood.com or at quicksandfood on Instagram. And if you want to get in touch with Simon, it's simon_evans_TBD on Instagram. Thanks so much for tuning in and we'll catch you again with another episode.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.